thank you for your patience, folks, to 1179.
Adopt Portland's 2016 Natural Hazard Mitigation Plan, also known as the Mitigation Action Plan, which characterizes Portland's natural hazard exposure, assesses potential impacts of natural hazard events, including physical and social vulnerabilities, and lists the strategies city bureaus intend to implement to reduce potential losses from natural hazards.
Mr. Novick.
Colleagues, the Mitigation Action Plan, or MAP, is a plan to describe the city's exposure to natural hazard risks and a strategy to reduce those risks over time through systematic investments in programs and capital projects. Most cities and counties in the U.S. have mitigation plans because FEMA requires such a plan for an entity to be eligible for mitigation grant funds. Mitigation plans must be updated every 5 years. This is Portland's third iteration of the plan. There are a few points about this plan we want to highlight. Equity. This plan was developed with an equity lens. We believe it's the first FEMA-compliant mitigation plan that also uses an equity lens. Some ways this is reflected in the plan. We had a 32-member steering committee that included three co-chairs from the OHSU Office on Disability and Health, from the East Portland Action Plan, and the Portland African American Leadership Forum. We offered two trainings in equity, vulnerability, and natural hazards to the steering committee and the interested public. The plan identifies and prioritizes projects that serve populations that are vulnerable to natural hazards: people under 15 years old, people over 65, renters, people of color, people with disabilities, and people in limited English-speaking households. The plan also represents a strong collaboration between bureaus. The following bureaus participated in the plan process and, quote, own projects in the plan. Every single bureau sent a letter of intent to work to implement their projects. The Bureau of Development Services, the Bureau of Environmental Services, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, the Citywide Asset Managers Group, the Office of Equity and Human Rights, the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management, Office of Management and Finance, the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, the Portland Bureau of Transportation, Portland Fire and Rescue, Portland Parks and Recreation, and the Portland Water Bureau. I hope we didn't miss any.
I think I could list which ones weren't.
I want to thank these bureaus and their commissioners and the mayor for supporting PFM's work. Finally, I want to point out that this is not a completely funded plan. In fact, many of the items are unfunded. There's a lot of projects in the plan, 159 to be exact. Some we can do with existing funding. Putting them into the plan records our commitment to carry them out. Others are good candidates for grant funding, and their inclusion in the plan enhances their grant eligibility. And some are reach projects that we can't do without outside funds and where we don't know how likely that funding is. It's still worth putting some of these into the plan so we can implement them opportunistically. It's not our expectation that all of the projects in the plan will be implemented. However, the plan included a rough qualitative cost-benefit assessment, and everything that moved forward has benefits that exceed the costs. So we could say all the projects are worth doing if we find an opportunity. While it is great that some of these items are funded, it's worth pointing out FEMA continues to allocate significantly more funds towards post-disaster mitigation than pre-disaster mitigation. We've been relatively successful in capitalizing on the limited amount of pre-disaster mitigation funds available from FEMA. But in the long term, it will take some advocacy. We know our congressional delegation is with us in this, for FEMA to allocate the bulk of its funding towards pre-disaster mitigation. And now I'll turn it over to Danielle from the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management, who will walk us through the main elements of the plan. Thanks, Danielle.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here. It is an absolute honor and just a pleasure to be here. We've been working on this for the last year and a half, and so it's very exciting to finally be here. It's today. So we're here today to ask you to adopt this plan. My name is Danielle Butzik, as Commissioner Novick said, and I am with the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management for one more day. I was brought here to update this plan, and that's what I've done. Here to my left is Mr. Rob Flaner with Tetra Tech. He's with the consultant company that helped us update this plan. So like I said, this project has been just a huge effort over the last year and a half, and many, many bureau representatives have helped with this plan, and also members of the community. This has been just a monumental outreach effort, and it's just been so exciting to see the community coming together around this important topic of hazard mitigation. Today, I want to talk a little bit about the plan content, what's in the plan. It is an 860-some page document, so I trust that you've read it all. it is a large document, but there's a lot of good stuff in there. But I do want to cover what mitigation planning is, what's in the plan, and talk about how we included equity in this planning process and why that's so important. I'll give just a brief snapshot of what we found in the risk assessment. I'll highlight the earthquake risks because that's kind of what's at the top of everyone's minds right now. I'll cover just a few of the actions that were listed in the plan. I believe there are actually 161 actions in the plan. We have added a couple after the draft comment period. And there was also a separate breakout study, the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub Risk Assessment and Recommendations Study. So I want to briefly cover that as well and then talk about the next steps for the plan. A mitigation action plan is the city's overall strategy to reduce our risk from natural hazards over time. And that means reducing our potential for injury, loss of life, property damage, and economic impacts. It helps us establish eligibility for federal grants. And as you'll see in these photos, I specifically wanted to call attention to the residential seismic strengthening project that we recently implemented and are in the process of implementing with federal funds, and the Johnson Creek restoration project, and that's another one of these photos that's here, and I know you're all very well familiar with those. What the Mitigation Action Plan does is it characterizes our risks from natural hazards, it describes our vulnerabilities, and it also lists actionable strategies that city bureaus can take over the next 5 years, ideally, to reduce those risks, to reduce those potential losses. The Mitigation Action Plan, like most plans, has a mission that it's intended to accomplish, and this is our mission, developed with the guidance of the Steering Committee. We want to equitably reduce risk and the adverse impacts of natural hazards by building community resilience through collaborative, cost-effective actions and strategies. This plan really focused on equity for a lot of reasons, but it's especially important in hazard mitigation because we think that if you don't intentionally build equity into these planning processes, you end up reinforcing or exacerbating existing historical inequities and disparities. And with hazard mitigation, with natural hazards, there's this concept of the social amplification of risk, which is the interaction of social demographic factors that work together with other vulnerabilities, physical vulnerability and hazard exposure, to create enhanced risk. So social vulnerability looks at the who might be impacted by natural hazards. And certain demographic characteristics might make someone more likely to experience detrimental impacts from natural hazards. That might be someone who has a physical disability, someone who has a language barrier and is less able to access information and services. It might be a person of color who experiences institutional racism and is often faced with barriers to services because of that. And so we think that social vulnerability is a big factor in this. Physical vulnerability is when structures are either old and haven't been built to very high code standards, or they may just be built of materials that are incompatible with a hazard to which they're exposed, such as a wooden structure in a flood zone or a fire hazard zone or an unreinforced masonry building in an earthquake hazard zone. The hazard exposure piece is the where, what areas do hazards occur in, so a floodplain or a seismic risk zone. So all of those work together to create risk or potentially impacts from natural hazards. The way that we incorporated equity into this process, and I assure you it's not a perfect process, but our attempt at incorporating equity into this process was by creating an equity lens. We asked ourselves questions about each of the actions listed in the plan, about how we could maximize the benefits of the plan for the people who are likely to suffer most from natural hazards. we asked how we could reduce the burden of the actions on those particular communities. The bureaus, I have to say the bureaus did an amazing amount of work going through each of their actions and doing this whole worksheet, asking themselves these hard questions and refining their actions to be included in this plan to make sure that they were maximizing those benefits. Like I said, there were a lot of people involved in this process. We had a 32-person steering committee that met monthly for the last year to talk about the planning process. They helped us refine the process. They identified our goals and helped us list actions that the bureaus could implement. And they also were a huge contributor to our public engagement strategy, which was how we interfaced with the public on this plan update. The bureaus provided their expertise on city infrastructure and existing programs or policies that we could use to work with this plan to help implement actions. And the public, of course, attended our workshops. They asked great questions. They helped us understand what their priorities were. And they really helped us refine the messaging in this plan to make sure that it was clear and was going to be useful to our public.
Before you move on from that slide, I just want to note and maybe explain to folks at home that that's using the consensus model, which is what we use in the Office of Neighborhood Involvement in our budget process, that people holding up a green card means that they're fine with what's being proposed.
That's great.
Yellow card means kind of slow down, and no means stop, and let's talk about this some more. So mm-hmm. Thank you for using that. I found it very helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah, we found that was a really fantastic tool, and it was actually something that came up after a couple of meetings where it was clear that there was a very large committee that needed a tool like that. But it was really effective, and so thank you. And of course, City Council plays a huge role in this plan because you're the ones who will adopt this plan, and ideally, and set hazard mitigation as a priority for the city and provide resources to implement the actions that are included in the plan. If you haven't read through the entire 860-some pages, you may wonder what exactly is in this plan. First of all, there is a risk assessment, which is the where. It talks about our exposure to natural hazards. It shows a bunch of maps, which are very colorful and beautiful, and they show us where our highest risk areas are. The vulnerability analysis talks about who's at risk. We did a lot of demographic analysis to show what populations are in higher concentrations in certain areas where there are natural hazard risks. And then there is the mitigation strategy, which intends to implement or lists potential actions that we can take as a city to reduce our potential losses from natural hazards. This is a snapshot from the risk assessment. This is a liquefaction potential map. As you can see, the brighter pink is where our highest liquefaction risk is. It coincides with the river, with both of our rivers, because liquefiable soils are found mostly in places where the water table is high, near rivers or streams. Liquefaction, for those of you who may not know, is a condition in which the ground is shaken and ground, which is normally solid under normal conditions, is shaken to the point where the soil particles actually separate and the ground behaves more like a liquid than a solid. And it can cause severe damage to structures on the surface, as indicated by this very informative graphic. Another map from our plan. This is a shake map of the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake scenario. A shake map is a map that's developed by the United States Geological Survey, and it uses data on what type of soil or rock configurations are present in an area. And it's important to note that this map itself is actually a very zoomed-in version of a large-scale map. So if you zoom out, it actually looks sort of like a bullseye around the Cascadia subduction zone scenario. And so there were two scenarios that we really looked at closely. Actually, it's four scenarios in the plan. But some of the scenarios that we really focused on were the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake scenario and the Portland Hills fault scenario for this plan. And as you can see, this map indicates light to strong shaking from the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, which contrary to what you know is sort of in the media right now, it may not be that bad from the Cascadia subduction zone. We still consider this our worst case scenario because of the duration of the shaking and the regional impact that we're likely to see from a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. It is really important also to note that there are local faults. I'll call your attention to the purple fault running along the west side of the Willamette River. That is the Portland Hills fault. That was the other scenario that we ran for this plan. And as you can see, the shaking is looking a lot more severe for the Portland Hills earthquake scenario. And that's for a couple of reasons. It's a surface fault. It's a crustal fault, so it's very close to the surface. And it's also very close to where we are. It's right along the Willamette River, so it's within our boundaries. So the proximity and to us and the proximity to the surface makes it a pretty rough ride for us when this actually breaks.
Danielle, as to yeah. when it actually breaks, it's my understanding that unlike with the Cascadia subduction zone where we can estimate the probability of the earthquake happening within, you know, the 20% chance in the mm-hmm. next 50 years, we don't have the ability to make those kind of projections on our local faults.
That's very, very true. And it is likely that the recurrence interval is far greater, thousands of years. Some of the reason that we aren't able to understand what the timeline is on these faults is because much of the evidence that we would see, like with the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, we learned a lot about the timeline from underwater landslides, and we could figure out the time on those. But with this, some of the geological evidence has been destroyed by landslides and geologic movement over time. So it's tougher for us to find out that information.
Well, I assume that in the 800 pages, not all of which we've all read, just because the danger is somewhere between light and moderate, or maybe light and strong, doesn't mean you should relax, right?
Oh, absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Quite the contrary. Yeah, but it also, to me, it seems like, I think we could give people false signals in a couple directions. One is to make it look like this really isn't that big of a threat, or that it's so apocalyptic a threat that there's no point in doing anything. But mm-hmm. We're actually in the middle, right, that you should go ahead and strap your house down. You should go ahead and have an emergency kit. In other words, the risk is in that we can do some things range rather than forget about it, it's never going to happen, or forget about it, you know, we're just all going to be mm-hmm. refugees without housing or hope if it does happen. You know, it's in that range of action matters, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. We are probably all going to survive. So you want to have a plan and you want to have your infrastructure back online for those days after. So as I mentioned, we did a very, very robust public engagement effort on this plan. The first step of that public engagement strategy was to put out a preparedness survey. And these images we used to graphically represent the hazards that we were focusing on for the plan. And you might notice there's kind of a strange-looking one in the bottom left corner. That is for space weather. That was something that our steering committee decided to cover as an emerging hazard. There isn't a lot of data to support what our risks might really be from space weather, but it was something that the committee found interesting and wanted to look into.
What is space weather? Yeah.
A coronal mass ejection, basically. It is a sunspot explosion.
Solar flares.
Which would create sort of an electric an electronic pulse that might damage infrastructure. So we received three.
I've now got one more thing to worry about. No, that one
you can't do anything about.
Yeah, right. It's tough. But we received over 3,000 responses to this survey, and we got just a whole lot of information from the public, and they were overwhelmingly interested in seismic retrofits for our schools. It was just a recurring comment that came up in many, many of the questions. The survey focused on what steps people have taken to prepare or to reduce their risk from natural hazards, what their experiences are with natural hazards, and what they think the city should be doing. The next step in the public...
Go on with that. Sorry. I just want to... And you're doing a great job. Sorry to keep interrupting.
No, it's fine.
I want to caution everybody that we do need to talk to our children and maybe others who've just come to this area, perhaps from overseas, about the relative risk of things. I think I maybe overdid it when my kids were growing up, and that my daughter is now terrified that something is, you know, our house is going to be swept away imminently. So I do want to just remind everybody that, yes, we need to pay attention to these things, and we need to remember that young people especially can be very easily scared.
Mm-hmm. So the second part of the public engagement strategy was a series of workshops. We held 9 what we referred to as Planning for Real workshops, to which we invited members of the community to come and participate with us and look at maps and figure out what the city's priorities should be for natural hazard mitigation. We asked them what they were most concerned about and if they had any experience with natural hazards. And also, similar to the survey, we asked what people thought that the city should be doing. What are the actions that our public thinks that we should be doing? Throughout this process, we engaged neighborhood coalitions primarily, and used a lot of their networks to outreach to the public. We also had a meeting with the immigrant and refugee community through the Community Engagement Liaisons program. You might be familiar with the program. It's basically how the city engages with our immigrant and refugee communities. They, in turn, the Community Engagement Liaisons that we worked with, held workshops in their communities, in their primary language, to ask questions like we were asking of them about priorities in hazard mitigation and what those folks worry most about. We also worked with the Coalition of Communities of Color and had a follow-up meeting with them on how their feedback was incorporated into this plan. The last part of the public engagement strategy was a series of summer socials. We had socials in the park where we invited the public to come and just ask us questions. We talked about the draft plan and did some science experiments with volcanoes and liquefaction demonstration. And it was just an opportunity for the public to come and interact with us, PBEM staff, and our neighborhood emergency team volunteers. I want to highlight just a few actions that are included in the Mitigation Action Plan. This photo is a photo of a solar pilot project, basically, in Eugene, Oregon, to help homeless populations with their electricity needs when they don't have a traditional way to plug in a laptop or a phone or something like that. That's something that the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is really interested in exploring. That's a few of the actions in the Mitigation Action Plan talk about solar plus battery storage projects, pilot projects in various locations, community centers, and in low-income neighborhoods that could really benefit from this technology. A second one is for us to really continue coordinating with the levee districts on permitting for new structures around the levees. As you can see in this photo, this home was actually built into the side of the levee. And it's very, very important from a levee management perspective to not have structures built into the levee. So that is something that Bureau of Development Services is working on. They are coordinating with the levee management district, but that's something that we want to highlight as very important in this plan. The next one I want to talk about is expanding neighborhood emergency teams into every neighborhood, including and other communities, not just neighborhood structure, but also other communities like immigrant and refugee communities and faith-based organizations. We also want to look at strategically replacing water pipes with earthquake-resistant materials. That's something that the Water Bureau is really looking closely at with the replacement of the Willamette River crossing, and they've recently completed a seismic assessment of a lot of their infrastructure, and they really want to look at where we can most effectively reduce our risk to our water system by replacing piping. The community was very interested in seeing additional trainings on disaster preparedness, home safety, and emergency response training that isn't necessarily as demanding of their time as neighborhood emergency team training. As you may know, neighborhood emergency team certification takes a lot of time, and you have to maintain it with volunteer hours, but people are very interested in learning how they can make their families safer, and they're interested in learning about how they can do non-structural seismic retrofits, like installing safety latches on their cabinets so that when an earthquake happens, all of the stuff in their cabinets doesn't fall out. So that's something that we added to the plan in response to community interest. The last one that I want to highlight is for Office of Equity and Human Rights and all of the bureaus, as they implement actions, to review them for any unintended consequences that might happen, to find ways that we can really work to reduce disparities in how hazard mitigation takes place. I have a photo here of the Johnson Creek Restoration Project, and I put that photo up there because that's an example of a project that could really benefit from an evaluation like that. Because a project like that, when you're offering even a willing seller program, there are potential negative consequences to the community. In renters might be displaced from their homes if their landowner decides to sell. So that's something that could really be evaluated to see if there's a way to provide renter support or something like that. I also want to just talk really briefly about the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub risk assessment. The Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub, as we are referring to it, is a 6-mile stretch along the southwest side of the Willamette River, where a lot of our petroleum infrastructure and electrical and natural gas infrastructure resides. This is a map indicating where our study area was. And this is not an area that we invented. It was actually based on a study done by Dogami in 2012. And I just want to highlight in this map the proximity of the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub to Forest Park, which, as we heard earlier, is a very, very critical asset to our city. It's very important to us. And then the Linton neighborhood is the only residential neighborhood that's located within the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub. There were 4 main findings from this study. The first being that the lack of data leads to a really significant understatement of risk. We didn't have a lot of data from the stakeholders in our study as we had hoped. We asked for data on vulnerability of the critical energy infrastructure. We didn't have a lot of response to that. We really think that it's important that we expand on this assessment and collect better data, more comprehensive data that can really give us a better picture of our risk. Most of the facilities in the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub are located on liquefiable soils. Assets in the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub are as old as over 100 years old, but some of them are relatively new. About 70% of them were built before 1974 when Oregon adopted a statewide building code. And as I mentioned before, the Cascadia subduction zone event is not our only risk. Of course, the Portland Hills fault is a huge risk to us as well. And the fault, as you can see in this map, there's actually an indication of where the Portland Hills fault is, and it runs right through that area. Some of the recommendations that came from the report, there were actually 9 of them. I'm going to highlight just a couple. First of all, and most important, is a critical energy infrastructure hub disaster resilience work group. We think it's really, really important that all of the stakeholders in these issues get together and talk about potential policy options and strategies that we could use together to increase our resilience in this area. This group could implement some of the other actions or recommendations that we have in the report, and they can also work together to advocate for even potentially building code revisions at the state level. Secondly, one of the other recommendations is policy implementation. So a short while ago, the City Council passed a resolution to reject any new fossil fuel infrastructure that is whose sole purpose is to bring more fossil fuels into the city of Portland. I think this is a huge step towards addressing climate change for Portland and taking a strong stance. And it's also an opportunity for us to focus on seismic safety of these facilities as well. So Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is actually working on terminal zoning regulations that could potentially implement this recommendation. There's also a facility inventory project that is hopefully funded, I believe, for inventorying the facilities that are in this critical energy infrastructure hub, so that we can have a better picture of what our risks are out there.
Just want to footnote that there's been really good work done, I think, between the bureaus on that effort, that is to both implement the council's direction about not expanding fossil fuel infrastructure here, but also send signals to the owners of that infrastructure that are attractive towards replacing older, more vulnerable tanks with newer, stronger ones. So I want to just commend the work that's been done by PBIM and BPS together, and I think Bureau of Development Services as well. Multiple right. folks brought their expertise to that, and I think you came up with a pretty elegant solution that actually manages more than one objective. So
Thank you. Yeah, it's a great opportunity. Next steps for the plan are it's currently under review by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Oregon Emergency Management Agency, and that review should be complete by December. We're hoping to have approval with your adoption by the end of the year. At that point, it will be on us to start implementing the actions in the plan, and the plan will also be maintained and annually reviewed and updated, and we will produce annual progress reports so that the public can be aware of the progress that's being made on this plan. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just another footnote on implementation of this. In our upcoming discussions about the fall bump, there's some small funding that's been requested to do some more research, for PBIM on critical infrastructure. So just want to flag that as one of the action items in mm-hmm. the action plan.
Okay.
Other questions for our team here.
What happens if the state and the feds reject our plan, but we've already adopted it? Does that mean we have to start back over and readopt something else?
It's possible. There is language in the resolution that says the adoption would be inclusive of any non-substantive changes that FEMA and the state request. If there are changes that are determined to be substantive, then it would mean coming back to council for readoption. The reason for this sort of rush toward the end of this project is because we're hoping to have the plan approved by the end of the year so that we can apply for pre-disaster mitigation funding that we became eligible for because of the December storms last year. So that money has been made available to us if we have an approved plan.
Great. Anything else either of you want to add? Thank you very much.
Thank
I know
you.
We have some folks that are here to speak on this item, so we'll take them and then move forward. So.
I show four
Thanks
people.
So much,
invited
Danielle.
Testimony, Steve? Yeah.
Yes, we do. We have Jeremy O'Leary from the East Portland Action Plan, Micah Meskel from the Portland Audubon Society, and Catherine Hardinger from BBS.
I'm probably going to be leaving us a little bit early, so I'll turn it over to you, Dan. We've got to go tell people how to get on with life on Northwest 23rd this evening. So
yes,
speaking of disasters.
Well, first off, I want to applaud the PBIM and the city for shoehorning in equity into an effort by FEMA that was never required. And so as with all efforts where you shoehorn in something after the fact, there's always rooms for improvement afterwards. I mean, it just so thank you, and there's a lot more work to do on that. And please continue the great work on community outreach and equity when you all the future plans around seismic retrofits and the energy hub and all the associated ones. So it needs to be MAP is mostly, the Mitigation Action Plan was mostly about, hey, this is how the bureaus can figure out how to keep doing their whatever they're doing after the disaster. MAP is not about, hey, this is how we make a resilient Portland. This isn't about recommendations to the citizenry on, hi, do these five things. One of the things, yes, now school, doing the seismic upgrades of the schools, by all means, but there's one thing to do life safety seismic upgrading, and then there's functionality upgrading. So, and it's been shown in a lot of disasters around the world that until the local school is online again after the earthquake or the whatever disaster, the community doesn't really get going again. So that's just another, of course, but that's now other jurisdictions and all sorts of bureaucratic fun. And so I am the co-chair, one of the co-chairs for the East Portland Action Plan. And so one of the things, speaking specifically for the East Portland, is one, now we are blessed with seismically stable soils in East Portland. However, my concern is that post-disaster we'll see something very similar to what happened in Christchurch, New Zealand, is there was a wholesale displacement from seismically unstable areas to seismically stable areas, and thus displacing a good chunk of the vulnerable and marginalized population that we have. Given that I have the privilege of worrying about only this hypothetical disaster, whereas a decent chunk of our population is worrying about the day-to-day one of food insecurity and rent increases and et cetera, et cetera. And let's see, let me look at my notes. Also, as much as possible in the future, be thinking about your capital projects of how do we make our, like, the recovery phase after the earthquake or whatever disaster easier. It's one thing, yes, we need to, there's a sprint to make it through the disaster, and like, what do we do after the fact? And so, thank you.
Thank you. Back to next.
Mayor and commissioners, thanks for having us. My name is Micah Meskel, and I work for the Audubon Society of Portland, and I was on the committee, and also took part in the breakout CEI Hub work group. So I wanted to second Commissioner Novick and Danielle and Jeremy's points on the praise for this process, specifically around the purposeful equity work. And the collaboration between bureaus was great to see, too. It was really functional. So as the mission states, the intent of this plan was to reduce overall risk of adverse impacts of natural hazards by building community resilience. So this is a daunting task, as much of the city infrastructure and inhabitants are located in multiple natural hazard zones. We have over years developed our city in a way that puts people and property in harm's way, and in doing so, also put the ecological health of our community at risk. So through the risk assessment, we determined that there was more than 9,500 people and $6 billion worth of property at risk from a 100-year flood, and also 89,000 people and $20 billion worth of property on landside prone slopes. So these are significant numbers, significant human and economic resources that could be lost in a major hazard event, events that are becoming more frequent as climate changes. So one of the key takeaways from the plan is that we need to do a much better job of integrating the built and natural environments and giving far more credence to natural hazards as we develop. So this specifically includes, and these are included as action items, accelerating our commitment to green infrastructure to make our communities more resilient, widening buffers along rivers and creeks, protecting floodplains, and reducing rather than expanding development in floodplains and on steep slopes. So in recent years, the city has reduced many of its green infrastructure programs, and we feel that this plan is in part a call to reinvest in those programs. Another key takeaway is that we need to aggressively address some of the most hazardous situations. So here I would call your attention to the CEI hub study, as Danielle spoke about, and in particular the fossil fuel infrastructure that we have established in our earthquake liquefaction zone along the Willamette. So the CEI hub receives and distributes 90% of the fossil fuels that that powers the state of Oregon. So that's a significant portion of that, all in one location. It is also located in the extreme hazard zone of 6 of the 7 major natural hazards that we studied in the plan. So it's a very dangerous location. And most notably, the vast majority of the facilities are constructed on soft, liquefiable soils that are typically associated with increased seismic vulnerability, and with most of them being constructed to low or no code standards. I would note that you have a significant opportunity in the next couple months to follow through on the ban new fossil fuel infrastructure in Portland. This is a critical first step that is laid out partially in the CEI hub step to ensure that we don't further exacerbate the existing hazards that we have in that location. And that, however, it is only the first step, that fossil fuel ban, infrastructure ban. We also need to speed up the follow-up and look how we can reduce the risk and increase the safety of existing facilities over time. So a couple ways we see that being accomplished is to fund PBEM and BDS's process to do a comprehensive analysis of the CEI hub and all the assets that occur there, to collect more data, run a community-led process, and formulate a legislative strategy to consider how building codes could be altered to require seismic upgrades in more expedited timeframes than what is currently happening. Further, we need to strengthen the current fossil fuel infrastructure code proposal from Planning and Sustainability Commission and designate existing fossil fuel facilities as non-conforming use. We see that as very important as it will require the necessary review processes for upgrades and further enable PBEM and BDS to process their process to require upgrades into the future on existing sites. So finally, to end, I would like to note two ways that we feel, Audubon feels, that this plan could have been improved. One is that we felt it failed to recognize the new floodplain protections that were put in place earlier this year as a result of a biological opinion released by National Marine Fisheries Services. So I understand that this process started before that ruling came into place, but contrary to the assertions in the plan, Portland will likely need to improve its floodplain protections in order to maintain its eligibility for the National Flood Insurance Program into the future. And so we think that needs to be explicitly noted in the plan. And second, there were a few committee members who felt that the plan should have actually been more aggressive in terms of addressing some natural hazards. And this is specific to our future regulations will be held to under the new biological opinion and additionally protecting specific areas. So again, we appreciate the opportunity to participate in this process and look forward to seeing it implemented.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Catherine Hartinger. I'm a planner with the Bureau of Planning Sustainability. I'm currently on the code development team, which seems like an odd match for this, but I was previously on the Central City team, and I was the Bureau rep on this process. I'm also an Emergency Coordination Center responder, but above all else, I'm a mom. I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, and their safety is everything. And so this was a really great opportunity to do something that was meaningful both professionally and personally. As a stakeholder advisory committee member, I attended the meetings and basically brought all that information back to facilitate conversations within my bureau. And that was a really interesting process because thinking about who in my bureau needed to be at those conversations and which teams this topic touches, and it really touched everybody. So I facilitated conversations with sustainability, solid waste staff, climate action plan people, environmental and river teams, Central City, et cetera. That was a really great opportunity. One thing that was really unique that's already kind of been touched on was this plan's emphasis on equity. As you know, equity was a priority of the Portland plan and a guiding principle of the new comprehensive plan. Using an equity lens to evaluate potential items was not a FEMA requirement, and I applaud PBEM for asking advisory committee members committee members and Bureau representatives to think about equity throughout the planning process. For our part, staff from throughout the Bureau came together to review and narrow down a list of action items, many of which were provided by community members, and think about how each might benefit or burden different communities. It was a really engaging conversation and really made us think about our Portland community and how differences in race, income, ability, language, and age, but also differences in housing tenure and type, might affect someone's ability to mitigate, prepare for, and recover from natural hazards. We learned a lot. I hope these conversations continue and that equity remains at the forefront of this plan as it's updated in coming years, and that ongoing outreach efforts strive to reach underserved and underrepresented communities so we can continue to improve our understanding of the needs and barriers that individuals and families face with regard to mitigation and preparation. And lastly, I want to thank PBEM, Carmen Merlot and Jonna Papa-Efthimiu for their leadership, and Danielle Butzik in particular for managing the process. And I look forward to our bureaus working together moving forward.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you all. Do we have anybody signed up to testify? Or?
Yes, I show three people left. I think Brian Hoop, I believe it's Denise Weller, and Daniel Siris. Okay, they may not.
Okay, come on up.
Go ahead. So my name is Brian Hoop. I'm wearing my private community member hat on today. I happen to live in Linton, as some of you may know, 10249 Northwest 109th Avenue. I'm on the board for the Linton Neighborhood Association, and the president was unable to come to attend today to give comments. I have the comments that we approved back in early September that we gave to PBEM, which you may already have, may not. I just want to comment that I've been in Linton for 20 years now and have grown to see Linton as a very feisty and resilient community, ready to address the many unique geographical challenges that we face. And also had the privilege to actually be on the committee for this group the last several months as a supervisor for the city's disability program at the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. We were going through a staffing transition. And I got to also, I want to recognize Denise Weller and Rob Lee, represented the Linton Neighborhood Association on that committee process for a year or more. I want to appreciate PBEM and Commissioner Novick's leadership on this effort. One example in Linton, I really admire PBEM's efforts, have done a great job of helping us get a neighborhood emergency team going in Linton, and their training and their support for that team has been tremendous, so thanks for that. The Linton Neighborhood Association agreed with many of the recommendations, but not all, that I want to focus on. I think what we came to determine was primarily missing is Linton Neighborhood Association is looking for a commitment from our leadership of the council, our state legislators, metro and county, that we need to acknowledge there needs to be a long-term strategy for decentralizing the state of Oregon's energy infrastructure hub. As has already been said, the Portland Harbor, most of the energy infrastructure sits on a liquefiable fill area. It's not an appropriate site, and it's at great risk when an expected earthquake happens. I think what's also important to recognize is, this issue should have been included in the comprehensive plan, something we should be thinking about long term, and that this is more than just an issue that affects that kind of immediate area that was on the map around Linton. It's a regional and statewide challenge that goes beyond the Linton boundaries. I think there was a truck accident this December where a truck ran into a train parked along Highway 30 this past December, and the toxic clouds didn't really impact Linton as much as they impacted the folks of North Portland. So that's something to think about. Of utmost concern to us with the critical energy infrastructure hub issue is it's hinted at something this work group should look at is a possible buffer zone and possible voluntary buyout, which would impact a lot of people in Linton. And I'm just letting you know the Linton Neighborhood Association is quite committed that we will fight and oppose any consideration of such a proposal in the future. If I could just, a few more ideas that were important to us is, we also think there's a need for additional emergency supplies, potentially a fire station, emergency foam supplies in the Linton area. We would love to work with PBIM and the city to look at what kind of rule changes could happen so that rail cars with volatile fuel should not be parked within an urban area along Highway 30 or in other parts of the city as well. And we really appreciate that. I came to learn that there is an evacuation plan for Linton, but we need to work more closely with the residents to educate folks that it exists and what to do about it when an emergency happens. So thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Doris Weller. I'm on the board of the Linton Community Neighborhood Association. I'm a member of the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group for the Superfund site, and I'm a member of the Northwest Toxic Community Coalition for Region 10. So my power was out till 12:30 today, so the only thing you got was part of my testimony that is appropriate for this that I had for the Portland Planning Commission. So anyway, so that's what you have. So PBIM's mitigation plan is a rare opportunity to correct the big mistake of locating the fuel tank farms in Linton Wilbridge. It's an environmental catastrophe of epic proportions that is going to happen unless measures are taken to correct the air. Yume Wang of Dogami states that a worse site could not have been found due to liquefaction and lateral shifting. Lives will be lost, the river contaminated, Forest Park, and many communities seriously affected. Goal 7 of Oregon Land Use Goals and Guidelines, 3B, prohibits the siting of hazardous facilities in identified hazard areas where risks to the public safety cannot be mitigated. So I suggest you require rebuilding of the tanks to seismic standards of a 9 earthquake, or move the tanks to a safer location. Mandate insurance or surety bonds to cover the cost of the loss of life, property, and the environment should a natural hazard occur or accidents. And bring up current tanks. They should be designated non-conforming use to facilitate upgrades. A plan was suggested during the process for a voluntary buyout of the buffer zone in Linton using a fee from the sale of houses in Portland. Lintonites are very concerned. Our community has been established since 1843, easily 100 years before the majority of the tank farms were built. We have 4 generation families living in our neighborhood who really don't want to be displaced. We contend that there is a much larger area than the small buffer zone in Linton that will be affected. St. John's, Forest Park, the Willamette, the Columbia, and the industry employees. And Northwest Portland and really the entire region will be affected by a hazard that could occur, earthquake hazard that could occur in there, or will occur in there. And another question was, why are the citizens asked to pay for the risks posed by multi-billion-dollar corporations? I mean, shouldn't they be supplying the money for the risk? We have dodged several bullets recently, as I have listed in the papers that distributed to you. Please use this opportunity through PBIM's resiliency plan to save lives and the environment, and avoid an environmental catastrophe and lessen the effects of natural hazards.
Thank you.
Thank you. You mentioned that your power was out until 12:30 today. What time when did it go out?
Last night, sometime.
And is that something that happens often, that the Linton neighborhood is without power when everybody else is
back
on?
It happens, especially I live on Turmentown Road, and oftentimes there's trucks that are not legal there that go driving through there and knock the branches down and put the power lines out. Also, the trucks and exit traffic are causing problems with the degradation of the road. And so actually this was a power pole that was right next to the road that went down and took it all over power.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
My name is Kathleen Milne, also Casey. And I want to just make probably about 3 points. One, that to just acknowledge the work of the committee, which I was part of, and the leadership, it was absolutely an honor to be part of that. Also, the points that are being made, I totally support. The other piece from my earlier testimony, you might recognize that my background in nursing and public health, I would like to suggest that what's being presented here has another element that is important to consider, and that is look at how we are developing Portland. I happen to live in a condominium that is in the downtown area, and as we build higher and higher buildings, it's not that the buildings won't stand, but when you've got a loss of power, of plumbing, electricity, etc., we are asking for much more complexity in the recovery and care of people. We've got elders. A lot of the areas that we've wanted to make sure we take a look at in this plan are going to be at risk in the downtown area, the areas that are most at risk. We need to be considering how to prepare for the influx of people in Portland. Totally get it. Totally know that's going to happen. I just hope we don't increase the chances of more problems in that process. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. I think we had maybe one or two more people.
Definitely one more, Mr. Sears, and Mr. Wilkins wants to speak as well.
Come on up. Start with you, sir.
My name is Dan Sears. I'm the conservation director for Columbia Riverkeeper, and on behalf of our membership, I want to support the Hazard Mitigation Action Plan and support the testimony that Micah Meskel gave earlier. I think the most important piece that I would like to convey is that there's a really critical overlap between this and the fossil fuel policy. And the interplay between the two, I think, is just important for you to consider, because in the next couple of months, you'll have people coming to you talking about that other policy. We strongly support the idea of funding a plan with further study, further community involvement, and a path forward to find a way to improve the seismic readiness of the tanks that exist along the Columbia River and the Willamette River. This situation is something that obviously is of deep concern for our over 10,000 members, both for its public safety implications and also its ecological implication. And so the Portland fossil fuel policy, I think, is ready to be a nice fit with this plan, and they fit well together, particularly in using the non-conforming use designation for existing facilities as a fit with this. We think that would properly incent the type of seismic upgrades that are really spelled out as necessary in this plan. So I think funding PBEM and Bureau of Development Services to collect information, involve the community, and form a strategy to require seismic upgrades is the proper path that's laid out in this plan. Thank you.
Mr. Wilkins?
I'm Cedric Wilkins, and I believe this, that if there was an earthquake at Mount Hood and we don't filter the Bull Run water system, there could be particulates stirred up. I really, in the future, would wish this city would help school children, because of the lead issue and the lead pipe is not controlled by the city, to drink bottled water. People don't know this. I make $8,000 a year. I'm on food stamps, and I can buy bottled water. So anybody who's low income really can have their kids go to school with a bottled water. The school situation also is weird, because several school officials in Portland have resigned because they wouldn't admit the water had lead in it. I just don't care. It's just, when in doubt, have your kids drink bottled water. I even have an idea that Benson High School, Benson made the Benson Bubblers because he didn't want his employees to drink alcohol on it, you know, downtown or something. Benson High School should maybe manufacture or even study how to make purified water. It's not easy. You have to boil it, or you have to run it through filtration systems. You have to test it. Maybe they could investigate that and even let their own students and the general people drink the water that they make and give it in honor of Benson. On the issue of coronal ejections, the sun emits a coronal ejection every 11 years. And between Apollo 16 and Apollo 17, they worried that the astronauts may die on the moon. and because of the not the person up around the moon, but the people on the moon. In 1850, there was a coronal ejection in which it destroyed telegraph wires and melted railroad tracks.
Thank you all. Okay, this is a resolution, so please call the roll, Carla.
Novick?
Thank you very much to Danielle and Jana and the rest of the PBM team. Thanks for everybody who participated. People raised some difficult questions. Like, it is absolutely true that this is